and it again with the Metaphysical Hour. Okay, one thing, I'm very glad to be back in the United States. Last week I broadcast from the UFO conference in Eureka Springs, and I said then that the next time we had a show, I was going to talk about my trip, because I was gone 5 weeks, and I went to just all the way around the world and back. So I wanted to talk some about that before I get into some other things anyway. I've been getting emails from people, and they say they enjoy that when I talk about my trips and talk about the things I've been doing. So I hope so, anyway, because I'm out of the country so much now. But I left the end of February and was gone the entire month of March and just got back the first week in April. And during that time, I know blogging service was, BBS Radio was doing their moving to California. So a lot of these shows were reruns while they got all of that set up. So now we're going to be back to live again. But when I left, I first went to, Amsterdam. I had to do a class there, and I had some lectures. And one thing with this trip, I don't think my body knew where I was after a while, because I was all over the place, traveling in so many different climates. And when you could do that, it's hard to figure out what to take with you, what to pack to take with you. I first went to Amsterdam and had a class there, because I am teaching my hypnosis method now all over the world. And it is being done outside of the country as well as classes inside the country. And normally when I travel, one of my daughters goes with me because as a lot of you probably know, my daughters work for me. This time I didn't have anyone of the family to go with me. And I had to have someone because there's so much business that is transacted while I'm traveling also, so I need someone who can do that. So I asked a friend of mine if she wanted to go. I said, would you like to go to India, Russia, Holland, be gone for a month? And she was so excited, she almost fell off the chair. So she said she definitely wanted to go with me. And she had quite an experience because she had never been out of the United States before. And so it was quite an experience. But first we went to Amsterdam, and there we had some problems with the visa that I need to get into Russia. Last year when I went over in May, we also had problems with the Russian visa. It seems to be that's the hardest one to get. They only let you have it for just the amount of time that you're going to be in that country. You can't get it for more than a month, and you can't get it more than a month in advance. So it was pretty hard to get it before we left the States. And last year when I went over, I had to go to the Ukraine, and that was easy enough to get that visa. We went to several other countries. And when I got into London, I thought, well, I'll be able to get my visa there at the Russian embassy. Turned out you couldn't. They have a waiting list of almost a month just to get into the embassy to sign up for the visas. So I said, oh boy, now what am I going to do? I had to go from London to Oslo in Norway on that trip, and I thought, well, I can get the visa in Norway. And I get to Oslo, it happened to be a Russian holiday, so the embassy there was closed. So I was beginning to wonder if I was even going to be able to get into Russia, because that was my first trip to do it. My Russian publisher, his main office is in Kiev, in Ukraine. And we had to go there next after Oslo. So they said, don't worry about it. We'll be able to get the Russian visa when we get to Kiev. And that was the last chance. But I've got a really good publisher. He is translating many of my books into Russian. But I've got a really good one. And he said, don't worry about it. If you're not able to get the visa, you can just stay in Kiev and we'll take care of all the expenses. So, okay, but I had the feeling I was supposed to go to Moscow. So it ended up we were able to get the visa on that trip at the very last minute in Kiev. So I don't like to push it that close because something can always happen. So this time it was going to be the same kind of a rigmarole because by the time I left the States, I knew it was going to be impossible to get the visa in time to make the trip because if you get it too far in advance, it's not any good because it's only good for a month. So we were in Amsterdam and I thought, well, okay, I'll get it here before we go on because we had several other stops and it'd be all right to do there. Well, first I was staying in The Hague, which is south of Amsterdam. Now, The Hague, many of you may know, is the headquarters for the International Courts. It's famous for that. It's very much like the UN because they handle cases from all over Europe and all over the world, I believe. I didn't get as much information about it as I would have liked. But I was staying in The Hague, and they said, don't worry, they have an embassy there, or it's more or less like a consulate. You can get your visa for Russia there. So we go over there, and when we left Arkansas, it was in the 70s going on 80, very rare, very warm for February. We get into Amsterdam and The Hague and Holland, it was cold, snowing, and much different. So we go down to The Hague to get my visa. They took one look at my passport. They said it was too full. I had one page left at the back. I thought they could put a visa on, and they said, no, that page couldn't be used. I've already gone through two passports up before this one, and they're supposed to be good for 10 years, but I travel so much that we just filled them up. This one I'd only had 5 years, and it was already full. They said, you're going to have some more pages added, which you could do, but they couldn't do it. So they said, you're going to have to go to the American Embassy, and... Turned out the only way I could get this done was in Amsterdam. So we had to take the train to Amsterdam to the American Embassy there to get my extra pages added. But this was beginning to get to the ridiculous stage that every time I try to get into Russia, we have all of these problems. So we spent the whole day in Amsterdam getting the extra pages and then getting the visa that I needed to get into Moscow. Then I had to start my classes and my lectures in The Hague. So after spending a week there doing all of that, my class usually goes for 3 days. And in that time, I teach the technique that I have developed that I use in my hypnosis. Because it is a unique technique that I've developed myself. And this is what I teach when I do my classes in the States and in these other countries. So I did that there for a week. Then I had to go on to New Delhi in India. I had to speak for the International Hypnosis Conference that was being held in New Delhi. So we go from snow, where the wind is blowing around the buildings off of the North Sea. It's very cold. And we're all bundled up, and we get to New Delhi. It wasn't quite as hot as it would be other times of the year, but it was still up in the 80s. So you would think that'd be a shock to your system to go from so many different climates. But we got to New Delhi, and we were put up at a really nice hotel where they had the conference. And this went on for almost a week, it's called the World Congress, World Hypnosis Congress. And people came from all over the world for this conference. And it is for those who are professionals in the hypnosis. There were a lot of doctors and professionals there. And they're mostly learning about past life regression and past life therapy. So I do know that this technique of past life therapy is spreading everywhere. When I began this 30, 40 years ago, nobody took past life regression seriously. It was always thought of as just something for New Age kooks. And they would laugh at you. But now I can see the advances we have made in this, and it is turning into a serious science that they are taking seriously now. They say it doesn't matter if the doctors, psychiatrists believe in it. They are seeing that it is a benefit, and it's working. So that's the main thing. They can go ahead and use it. So that's what's happening now. There's more and more of these past life regression conferences popping up everywhere. So that's what this one was for. It was not regular hypnosis. It was focused for the past life regression. So I spoke there. Mostly they wanted me to talk about my work with UFO cases that I've done for 20 years, because they said nobody else had had that much experience with UFO cases. So that was what they wanted me to focus my talk on. But while we were in New Delhi, part of the conference was to take busloads of us up to see the Taj Mahal. That's something I always wanted to see. So when I'm doing these trips, I do try to work in some play time anyway, where I can get to see things, especially if it's something that I had never seen before. Otherwise, every airport looks the same, every hotel looks the same, every conference center is the same, and you're usually stuck inside. You don't really get to see the country or anything about the place you're at unless you have someone to take you somewhere or unless the conference has these special trips arranged. And to me, that's wonderful to get to do these things. Part of the reason I agreed to go was I did want to see the Taj Mahal. The only thing about India that I found was depressing and disappointing was the extreme poverty. I guess I wasn't prepared for that, and my friend definitely wasn't, because she had never been out of the United States, and it really hit her hard to see such a contrast in the way people live. I, you know, lived in the Philippines back in the 1960s for 2 years while my husband was in the service, and I had 2 children that were born over there. And there was poverty there, people living in the grass huts on the stilts, but it wasn't that bad. We got used to it. But this was more than I had ever seen anywhere. Even in Peru and those countries in South America, I've never seen poverty as bad as it was in India. And I've heard about it, but I guess until you actually go there and see it, it's something you're not really prepared for. The people living on the streets with nowhere to go. That's what my friend was saying, that the homeless in New York are wealthy compared to these people. There's just no contrast between the homeless that you see in the United States and these poor people, because they have to live on the streets any way they can find a place. And this means cooking on the streets, you know, everything, because there's just nowhere else to go. And I talked to some people about this, and they said in the old days it was a lot better. There were a lot more people living out in the countryside, taking care of growing the crops. And this was where they would have been much better off. But you know how people are all over the world. The same thing happens in the United States. People always think if they can go into the city, there'll be jobs, they'll be able to get more money, they'll be able to support their family better. So that's what began to happen in India. The people began to go into the cities and to try to get jobs. Well, like anywhere, you get too many people, and their population is very large over there. You get too many people going into a city trying to find jobs. There isn't enough to go around. And I guess they stayed because they thought they could make some money anyway. Well, I've talked to some other people and since then, and they said used to be that the people could make money farming, but that now the government is not subsidizing them like they should be to give them the money that they can live on the farms. So they're starving to death out there. So what are they going to do? They are going to head for the cities where they think they can find something anyway. even if it's just begging, they figure at least they'll have some money. And that's what's happening. But it was discouraging to see all of this. We were, as long as we were in the hotel, in the compound, the ground surrounding the whole the hotel, it was like being in two separate worlds. As though the caste system is really very much still alive over there. Now, probably I'm going to get some emails from some of you saying, I don't understand this, what's going on, and maybe I'm judging. I'm not judging, I'm just reporting what I saw. And maybe I do have it wrong, because some people have corrected me since I got back, that it's just too big of a problem for the government over there to try to work this out. But anyway, it is a big extreme from the very poor to the others that have jobs and have money and have houses. So on the one day then, we went to Agra to see the Taj Mahal. That was a long trip. All day. We started out early in the morning. We didn't get back till 11 o'clock that night. Because it's a lot farther than we thought it was going to be. But the minute we left the compound of the hotel, we went for hours where it just was just part of the city. I kept saying, well, when are we going to get out of New Delhi? Because it was just crowds of people and poverty all along the sides of the road. And I said, when are we going to get out of the city? And we just kept going and driving for hours. There'd be a couple of times you would see a few fields here and there, but not enough like we would have here, like in Arkansas. It's mostly rural, which is a total 180-degree opposite from the way it was over there. And we stopped for lunch, and it would always be at a very nice place. They took very good care of us. But I guess all of this kind of spoiled what I was expecting from the Taj Mahal, because of all we had to go through to get there. Now, the Taj Mahal is said to be the most beautiful building in the world, and I've seen pictures of it where it is. It's very beautiful. Well, the time we arrived there, there was, you know, beggars and everything all around the gates as we right before we're going to go in, and I guess it kind of took away from it. But when we went in, walked onto the grounds, it is very awe-inspiring to see the Taj Mahal and the reflecting pool. That is awe-inspiring. But all the pictures I've ever seen of it have always been just that, the Taj Mahal and the reflecting pool. But when we actually got inside, there were mobs of people, all these tourists had come from everywhere to see this. So it wasn't isolated the way you would think it was going to be from the pictures. There were just mobs of people all over the place. But it was very beautiful, and we spent several hours there. But it is a tomb. That's the only thing that was inside of that building, was the tomb of the wife, because it was built for her. And I think his is in there also, I believe. But we couldn't get into that one part because they said parts of it have been closed off because people were doing graffiti, which is very disrespectful because this is a very beautiful place. But we got to see it, and it was something that I will never forget. But it may have been better if we hadn't have had to go through all of the poverty before getting there to see this wonderful place in the middle of Agra. And we walked around to the back of the Taj Mahal. There's a river. And it used to be a huge, beautiful river. But now it is reduced to just a small stream. And the people were saying the river is dying. And there was one woman in our group who says she goes all over the world and she's checking all this out. But she says it's happening everywhere, all over the world, that the rivers, the water is changing. There is lakes. I know there's supposed to be one in Russia that is shrinking. There's many other places where the rivers and the lakes are drying up. But then now we hear about the ice caps melting, and which are raising the water in some parts of the world. So it seems almost like a contradiction with all of these. Where, why is the water disappearing in some areas where people need it, and you have too much in other areas? But a man that I know who is very familiar with India said it was a big, beautiful river until they began damming it up. And the dam, they dammed it up to use the water for irrigation for the crops. And this is what's reduced the river to this small stream now in the back of the Taj Mahal. So I suppose there are reasons for all of these things. And my friend kept saying, they need to bring industry in here. They need to bring in something to give people jobs. Well, I've heard they are, because in Bangalore, they are bringing in all of the computers into that area. But that's it. It's mostly technology. People can't get jobs unless they have training in this technology. So, anyway, these were some of my impressions of India. And we went there. We was there for a week, and I did my talk. I stayed after the conference because they wanted me to do another talk for the general public, the ones who were not the professional hypnotists, the ones who just wanted to come and hear the talk. So we were there for a week, and then we were supposed to leave this next morning to go on to Moscow. And what was supposed to have been a 6-hour flight from New Delhi to Moscow turned into 10 hours. We sat on the runway for over three and a half hours waiting for the plane to take off. This was a Russian airline. And we said, what's holding it up? When we got on the plane, it was still dark. And they said there was fog. And I thought, well, the fog will burn off by as soon as the sun comes out. But we kept sitting there. And we kept asking the stewardess, and they said, well, there's fog everywhere. We can't take off until the fog lifts. And I'm sitting here with all these people around us in their saris and their turbans, and these men kept saying, but we don't have fog in New Delhi, especially in March. We don't. And we said, well, so they hadn't had any rain. They said, well, there was fog out there. And the Russian airliner didn't have any movies. It didn't have anything. So we just sat there waiting for it to decide to take off. I started using my visualization and talking to the fog, saying, you don't want to stay on the ground like this. You don't want to stay on the earth. It's too dense and heavy. Suppose we evolve. Let's reincarnate. Let's evolve, and you can lift off the earth and change into a nice, beautiful cloud and drift up in the sky. Then you can just drift around and make rain somewhere. Isn't that a good idea? Let's just leave the earth and go on up and become a cloud. I thought if I could talk to it, maybe we could get it to dissipate and get off the ground. Those of you that know me know that this is what I do anyway. Anyway, after a little bit, it finally did begin to thin out to where we were able to take off. But it was a long, long flight to Moscow. No movies. And a very, very crowded plane. Then we get into Moscow. We were late getting there because of the long delay. And I thought I was going to have plenty of time. But when they met me at the Moscow airport, they said, you've got a book signing and a lecture tonight. And that left me about 3 hours at the most. And I said, well, I'd hoped to get, you know, to go back and get something to eat, relax for a little bit. And they said, there's not going to be time. So they had to take us right to the hotel and then get ready for the lecture and the book signing that night. And here we are coming from the warm climate in India into 4 feet of snow in Moscow. And The people in Moscow know how to take care of their streets because they keep the streets cleared off and the sidewalks. But still, it was very cold. So I could just see my body saying, what are you doing to me now? You're switching around too much here. But my publisher there had planned a very extensive publicity campaign the whole time I was there, because he has now translated more of my books into Russian, and more people are learning about them. The first book he translated last year was the one Between Death and Life, and that's already now, I believe, in its third printing. It is selling very well in Russia and the Ukraine. So this time, they translated my book, Jesus and the Essenes. And I was very excited about that because it just came off the press in time for the first book signing. And I got to see it for the first time. And those of you who are not writers, I don't think can understand the excitement and the sense of fulfillment to see your book traveling everywhere and transforming into all these different covers and different appearances. It's like my books had gained a life of their own, I guess you would say. I felt like, you know, a writer feels that you create the book. It's like having a child. You have a baby. But then the baby grows up and it goes off into the world and it takes on a life of its own, becomes its own entity. And that's what my books have done. My 13 books have taken on a life of their own, an energy of their own. And they are all over the world now. And they handed me the new book, a copy of the Jesus and the Essenes. And I was so happy that they kept the cover, because the picture that I put on the cover had a very special meaning. And it is described in the book how that picture came to be. And they kept the same picture, which I thought was wonderful that they did that. And it was funny. I would hold the book in my hands and I said, that's my baby. That's my baby. It's taken on another form now. But what was supposed to have been an hour lecture, because remember, I haven't had any rest. It's very hard to rest on these long flights at very crowded airplanes. I hadn't had any rest, and I figured, well, I'll do the hour lecture in the book signing, then I can go back to the hotel. Didn't turn out like that. It ended up being over 2 hours, everybody asking questions. And when I go to countries like that, we always have a translator. And this translator was one that was with us when we were there last May. She's a beautiful young girl who is very wonderful and easy to get along with. And her English is impeccable. And I need someone like that. And she understands metaphysics, so she can translate for me. And she was the one, they said, do you want the same translator? And I said, yes, because Julia had been wonderful when I was there in May. So they had the same girl come again. And when we're over there in Moscow, they have our own driver that picks us up and takes us anywhere we want to go. And our translator is with us at all times. But finally, I got out of there. I got some sleep. Then started 2 days of nonstop magazine interviews. They had set up for publicity. These were big magazines. They were the Russian editions of Cosmopolitan and, what's the other one? ELLE. They were big magazines they have over here, but these were the Russian branches of those magazines. And we had 2 days set up where I was going to be interviewed by one after the other reporters all day for 2 days. In the beginning, I said, you know, it'd be a whole lot easier if we had all of them come at one time and have like a press conference and just let them all ask questions and we get it over with all at once. They said, no, the magazines don't want to do that. Each one wants to tell their story and their article in their own way. They have their own questions they want to ask. So we have to do one after the other. That gets a little tiring when they're all asking pretty much the same questions, but they want to write it from their own slant. By this time, my friend was tired of the trip, tired of all the things we were doing, even though we weren't even halfway finished. So when I was going for the magazine interview, she said, "Do you need me today?" And I said, "Well, not really. We're not going to be selling any books. There's nothing for you to do." She wanted to stay back at the hotel. And she said, "I'm tired." So she stayed in the hotel and slept. And I said, "You're tired. I'm the one that's doing all the work." But anyway, for 2 days, it was nonstop publicity. And then I had to do some talks. And these were open to the public, and we talked about the new books and lectured on those. Well, all during the magazine interviews, too, my little trusty translator was there, and she was just wonderful. I couldn't have done anything without her. But then what I was really worried about was I was going to give a class in Russia. Now, I've given classes in many foreign countries, but this one I knew I was going to have to do it with a translator because they don't speak English, only very few. And I only had about two in the class that could speak English. I knew it was going to have to be with a translator. So I worried about that the whole time we set up the trip and going over there. I was thinking, how am I going to be able to do this? Because it would take longer with the translator. But the main thing is, on the last day of my class, I give a demonstration of how the technique works. I said, how are we going to do this with a translator? Because the translator can't be translating while I'm doing a hypnosis session. So it was going to be tricky, and I wasn't sure how it was going to work out. Now, when I was over there in May, I met with this one man. He's a doctor over there. It's Dr. Yakov Galperin. And he is forming an organization that's going to be worldwide, where he is trying to unite all of the alternative healers and practitioners in the world, and is turning into quite an ambitious project. He wants to have the names and to make a worldwide organization of all of the herbalists, the naturalists, homeopaths, naturopaths, anybody working in alternative healing. And he spoke to me last May. He wanted to know if I could help him to get this going in the United States. So when I was there this time, I also had to have a meeting with him, as we discussed this some more. And he arranged for several of his friends who were doctors and psychiatrists to take my class because he said they wanted to start using this method in Moscow and in Russia. So we had the class with the translator, and this is the first time we had more men than we have women. Usually it's the other way around in any metaphysical things I go to. But there were psychiatrists and doctors present, and I did the best I could with the translator, and I had handouts that had been translated, hoping they would be able to understand. And we decided to go ahead and do the demonstration, and I used my translator as the subject because I knew she could understand English. The doctors filmed the session, and they were going to have it translated so they would be able to understand it. And I had my class for 3 days with them, but this was one of the hardest ones I've done. It turned out fine, but then Dr. Galperin told me afterwards what he wanted to do was either I come back to Moscow and work with these doctors later to make sure they are doing it correctly, or they could come to America and work with me here just to make sure they're doing it correctly. So I guess I'm going to be having a lot more dealings with Russia. But the people there are wonderful, and they've always treated me very nicely when I've been there, and I've had no problem. The only problem is getting the visa to get in there in the first place. Once you do that, you're fine. So anyway, by the time we left Moscow, we had been 3 weeks, and I was getting a little tired because it was one thing after the other. I hadn't had a day off. So then we had to go to London, and I had many lectures scheduled in London. We also had some time off. So knowing that my friends had never been to Europe, I wanted to schedule some things for her in London that she would never get to see otherwise. So on the 2 days we had off, we scheduled some sightseeing so she'd be able to see these things. And the one was a half a day one where we just went around London and she got to see all of the buildings and the things there. But I really wanted her to see the Tower of London, to see the Crown Jewels. And if you've never done it, it is really something to see. Because these are, they said, the most valuable in the world. They can't even insure them because they are worth so much. The largest diamonds in the world are in the crown and in the scepter. It's amazing to see the jewels. It was cold in London, too, but we didn't have to do so much walking around, just outside in the Tower of London. So we went to several things that she could see. One of them was the boat trip down the Thames, the River Thames, that led us out right at the Tower of London. If you ever get a chance to go to these places, you need to see these things. Last year, when I was in Moscow, I wanted to see the Red Square, and I was able to do that. This time, I let them take my friend because I'd already seen it. So I'm getting to see all the things all around the world that I always wanted to go to. In addition to lecturing and spreading my work, I am seeing some things. But then on the next day, we had an entire day. So we scheduled a bus trip that was going to go out of London. And it went to Windsor Castle, where the Queen stays on mostly on the weekends. She stays at the Buckingham Palace in London during the week, and then she goes out to Windsor Castle. And they have tours of Windsor Castle. And the opulence is beyond belief. You cannot really comprehend the wealth in that castle and how anyone could even live in it. It is just so much. There is just, it's just hard to describe. The furnishings, the paintings, everything is extreme wealth, and it is just very, very beautiful. That's the first time I had seen that. I hadn't got to take that tour. But then from there, we went out to Stonehenge, and she wanted to see that. And she got very excited, my friend did, as we came in on the bus. If you've been to Stonehenge, it sits on a plain that is just wide open. I mean, there's no houses, there's nothing. It just sits out in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of this huge open plain. Field, or just, it's not even a field, it's just an open plain. And we could see it from a distance, and she got very excited. She said this meant more to her than seeing the Taj Mahal. But see it from a distance, she got very excited, and she said, I feel like I'm coming home. Which might mean that she'd had past lives there before. I don't know. But we spent that hours walking around around the circle with the rocks, because they won't let you inside of it. But it is quite a spiritual feeling, even though I've been there several times, to be there. It's a strange feeling, a feeling of ethereal calmness as you walk around that area. Almost like there is something sacred or metaphysical or special or spiritual about that area. But the wind was blowing so hard and it was so cold out there. But we did get to see that, and then we went from there to Bath. And I've been through Bath, but I had never seen the museums there. And this tour was the Romans way, way back during the Roman days, had a city there, the city of Bath, which they had found hot water springs underneath the ground. And so they built these huge bathhouses there. And this is where, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years later, the city of Bath has now come from. And the hot springs are still there. So when the explorers, the archaeologists, excavated, they found the ruins of the bathhouses and the springs, and they built this museum all around it. So it was really good to see that. And I love museums, and I like archaeological things anyway. So that was really interesting to see that in the city of Bath. So there's many, many things in England you could take a whole month, really. I don't think you'd be able to see it all. Every time I go, I try to see something that I haven't seen before. But it was very interesting and beautiful. But also, I had work involved. I had to speak at the College of Psychic Studies. Usually when I go over there, I speak at many different organizations. They have me come back again and again every time. I try to alternate now, so I won't go back to the same organizations each time I return to London. I speak at the Theosophical Society, and I did that in May when I was there last year. This is the headquarters in London. And I speak at many other organizations, but I have spoke before at the College of Psychic Studies. This is one where you can get degrees in psychic studies, and it takes quite a while if you're going to take all the courses. But it's one of these big buildings. If you've ever been to London, they have these blocks and blocks of city, of buildings that are all alike, and they used to be manor houses way, way back, to where the whole three stories tall building would have been the home of one family and their servants. These are one after the other. They're all attached to each other like row houses. And in most places in London, these have been turned into hotels. So there's hundreds of hotels. But also over in the museum district around the Natural Science Museum and the Space Museum, there's a whole lot of museums are in one area. They have the College of Psychic Studies and the French School. Theosophical Society, all of these are in these big buildings that used to be private homes that have been converted into these places. The College of Psychic Studies has been there since the 1800s. Some of these places were started by people like Sir Conan Doyle. So they go way back to those eras whenever the people were beginning to become interested in psychic phenomena and wanted to have classes and teach these things. So I've spoken at the College of Psychic Studies many times, and that's what I had to do this time. I did 2 days of talks and workshops, and then I went to the yoga center, the yoga training center in London. They have one there. I work a lot with swamis and their ashrams, especially the Sivananda ashram. I work with just about every religion there is, and I have found no difference. Everyone is interested in my work and my findings, so I just go anywhere anyone wants me to come. If they ask me to come, I go. And the Sivananda group, I've spoken at their ashrams in the Bahamas and the ones in Grass Valley, California. And also the headquarters of the Sivananda group are up in the mountains outside of Montreal, Canada. I spoke there also. So this time they wanted me to speak at the one in London. So I took some lectures there. They want me to come back and speak at the ashrams in Paris. And see, they have one in the Alps in Italy, and they have some in Germany. That would be another trip where I will work all of that in and go from one ashram to the next. So it's like I'm never going to run out of places to go and places to speak, because it just keeps growing and growing. Everyone wants to know about all these things that are involved in my work. that's the amazing part, is my work just keeps growing and spreading, especially with all of the languages now that the books are being translated in. Oh yeah, when I left Moscow, they were already making plans to translate some more of my books. That's part of why they were having the publicity campaign. So I guess I'll be returning there. But on the very last day in London, my friend said, I want to go to a London theater. And she said, my treat, because, and the theater has never really appealed to me, but she said she wanted to do it. And I said, okay. I could have been doing sessions the whole time I was there, which I normally do, private sessions, but I decided, let's just have some fun and let's play on this trip. So the last night in London, we went to see The Phantom of the Opera. And she said it was the perfect ending to a perfect trip. And then we left the next day to come back to the States. Which would have been enough, being gone 5 weeks. I'm home 2 days and I had to go to Las Vegas, which was mostly a business trip. But we had to have a little fun there too, because the people we were meeting there took us to see Barry Manilow, and which my daughter is crazy about, absolutely crazy. So she really wanted to do that. She went with me on that trip. And they have the circuses, what I call them, I think they call them the Circus du Soleil, which put our circuses to shame. I mean, I don't want to say to shame. That's not the right word. I mean, they put it to where it is so ordinary. These are circuses like you have never seen in your life. I don't know how the people do the things they can do with their body. We're told probably they start when they're very, very young children. It's the only way they could ever get their muscles to do the things that they do. The same way they do in Bali and the India, where they start training the children to do these dances at very young ages when their muscles are very limber. But anyway, we did all of that, and I finally got home. Then last week, we had the UFO conference in Eureka Springs. So I keep thinking I'm going to have time here now to slow down and stay home for a little bit. But last week was the UFO conference, and I have helped with that for 19 years. It's been put on by Lou Farish. I wanted him to be the guest on the show last week and talk about the history of this conference, but he doesn't really like to do radio shows. So he just said, no, I went ahead and did Wendell Stevens. And those of you who might have heard last week's show, that was a fantastic guest. Very controversial. But then I've been told on this show I can talk about anything I want to talk about. So it was a lot of controversy bringing in government issues. So if you have a chance and haven't heard it, that was the show I did last week. And if you can download that from the archives, I think you'll find it very interesting. But Lou Farish is the one who has been putting on the show for, well, like I said, it's been 19 years that we've all been involved with it. Lou Farish has the UFO News Clipping Service. He started this, many, many years ago. And it's a mail out. I think it's got about 20 pages or more in it, where he has the UFO sightings and news from all over the United States. People, they have a news clipping service, and they send him these. And he puts them all together and combines them in this, like a newspaper. It's not like a magazine. It's more like a newspaper. And he is still doing that after all of these years. And he's also combining what he calls Fortiana, which is news of the unusual and the strange, also in that same paper. So we have been friends for over 20 years because we got together when I first began doing the UFO research. He was responsible for bringing me into the UFO research. So I've been doing that now for 20 years. And I've spoken at UFO conferences all over the world. And as you probably know, I have 4 books that I wrote about UFOs. In future shows, I'll be talking about all of these things. I've already done now, I think this is 16 shows, and I haven't even begun to touch all of the information that I have in my books. I've just talked about some, and I've had some guests, and we are going to have some more. Starting next week, I'm going to go back to the guests again. But eventually, I'll be bringing up all of my work with UFOs and with the abductions that I've covered. And in my book, The Custodians, I have covered just about every question anyone could ever want to know dealing with UFOs. And Lou has been a 20 years, he's helped me in my investigations and been there as a confidant when I needed that. And he is the one that started the UFO conference in Eureka Springs. We had over 400 people at this last one. That's usually the way it runs, about 400, 450. We have faithful people that come back year after year just to see what's going on. But in the future shows, I'll be bringing up the UFO findings and the material that I've had. But before I go off the air tonight, I do want to bring up that I am putting on my first conference. And it was like, I wanted to get the authors that I publish at my company, Ozark Mountain Publishing, I wanted to get them into other conferences where they could lecture. And all of a sudden, it came to me, why don't you put on your own? And I thought, what? But then it was like, well, sure, you can do it. You've been helped with so many, and I've spoken at so many. So we set about the wheels in motion, and we are going to have our first transformation conference, is what we call it, the transformation conference, and it's going to be held June 3rd and 4th. It's a Saturday and a Sunday, June 3rd and 4th this year, and it'll be held at the Clarion Inn in Fayetteville, Arkansas, which is very close to where I live. And our keynote speaker is going to be the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, who is Arun Gandhi. I am featuring the authors that we have published, and I published his book. I'm going to have him as a guest sometime in the next few weeks. We will be talking more about this conference. Anyone who is interested in the conference and wants more information, if you call my 800 number, we can give you all the information you need. And also, if you want information about my classes or about my book, this is the number to call, or about the conference in June. The number is 1-800-935-0045. 1-800-935-0045. Or you can check out everything out on my website, which is www.ozarkmountain. The name of my company is Ozark Mountain Publishing, but it's abbreviated on the website. It's ozarkmt.com. Ozark Mountain abbreviated. ozarkmt.com. There's a whole page about the conference and about the speakers. So you can get all the information you need about the books, about my classes, about the lectures I'm going to be giving, and about our conference. All right, so I guess that's going to be all for tonight, and I'll start up my guests again next week. And on the Bloggins website, we're going to start listing the speakers. Some of these are the ones we had to cancel when they were doing their move. So we're going to put them back on again.